Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, our favorite day of the week. We got something big happening. The Bitcoin Mina will take place on December 9th and 10th, 2024 at the ADNEC Center in Abu Dhabi. And it has a very, very special agenda and speaker lineup planned for us. Now, coming up first, my favorite one, Eric Trump will focus on Bitcoin's potential as a tool for financial independence, emphasizing its importance in wealth preservation during uncertain times in his panel. Secondly, we're going to have the Prince Philip of Serbia, and you know he's going to be there and he's going to be delivering to us how Bitcoin's potential for nation-state adoption, particularly in enhancing economic resilience, sovereignty, and growth across the MENA region. And that's what makes this summit truly exceptional. It addresses every critical global structure that impacts our lives, really, and reveals how Bitcoin is on the verge of becoming an integral part of them all. Keep in mind, Majid, whatever I just mentioned in the agenda is a drop in the ocean of speeches and panels that they're really going to provide for us. Is there a specific speaker that you're specifically excited
Eric
for?
Eric Trump.
For sure.
That's the
Me
biggest
too.
Guy, because Trump getting elected is a very important thing right now. And Eric Trump coming here to this region, to this country, and then to the capital, Abu Dhabi. It's a very nice thing that is happening. Do join them. Go to their website, find out about all the passes and every package that they have. They have a very ultra-luxury, high-end VIP pass as well. But they have very affordable passes as well. So whichever one suits you,
go there
and enjoy. Yeah.
You know, the one that I'm really interested in is there's going to be this panel with one of the men who's the closest to Donald Trump. And, you know, he's basically going to give like a timeline of everything. That one I specifically find so exciting. And they also have another agenda. I believe it was for how we can improve access to Bitcoin in the UAE.
Yeah.
That one specifically excites me the most because I feel that I can know more and that I can apply more and I can be a part of it through that.
The interesting part is if you're a newbie, you can go. If you're an expert,
even
then, it's like a good networking thing where you can go find people who are at the same level and have a chat with them about Bitcoin's future, because Bitcoin is doing great things. It's going up and down. It's reached the 100,000 mark nearly, went up to 96,000 something, but didn't exactly touch the 100,000 mark.
Majid has been obsessively watching it closely.
I love the journey of Bitcoin, how it's gone through. It's like the internet. The first time it came, everyone was against it or skeptic about it. Now everyone is on the internet. We have it everywhere. You can't live without it, basically.
Yeah.
So I think Bitcoin is maybe going to turn into a currency which everyone will eventually need.
For sure. I agree with you about that. And even more exciting, we have the 53rd National Day coming up on December 2nd. This is going to be absolutely insane. You know, just this morning, Majid, I was, you know, I was speaking to one of my best friends. She's Emirati. And, you know, when I look at this National Day, I really think about the youth of the Emirat. And they're really rising. Like, you know what her little sister is doing? When I heard this, I was absolutely baffled and proud at the same time. Her sister is 16. She has started an NGO to, an NGO in Kenya to support like more morality in pregnancies.
Nice.
Imagine, I was so proud.
And
I was
so proud. It's a 16-year-old thinking about such a big global issue.
Yeah, and she also started her podcast too.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, she started recording it, and I was just, I was completely proud. But, you know, as this 53rd National Day is coming up, I think that out of everything that we're seeing in this country, it's the power of the youth.
Yeah.
We're really seeing the power of the youth.
Yeah, I see it every day in Augustus Media. The interns that we have, they're exceptional. At this age, I don't know what I was doing, but they're very good. we had an Emirati intern, Hind. She was here.
Yeah.
She was great, but is working
Thank
with us
Majid.
For
I appreciate
she worked
you.
Here for 3 months now she's back again she's exceptional there's also I think it's not only for Emirati nationals also right everyone who lives in this country yesterday even Farah was saying that she was born and brought up in this country and she feels like she is a national
yeah
so that feeling of having a home away from home That feeling is great.
It's the best. Yeah, that's why today I'm in my mikhwara and my abaya because I was like, it's National Day. Yeah. Like I'm so excited. I'm so excited to eat legemat and just enjoy everything.
All the festivities of the season.
Yeah. Just to start with our first topic for today, Stripe has faced boycott calls after its CEO has visited Tel Aviv. Now, Stripe itself, it's a American Irish company, and it basically provides online and in-person payment processing and financial solutions for businesses of all sizes. But what really happened is that their CEO, Patrick Collison, posted on X that it's great to be back in Tel Aviv. I missed this run. Now, what this did is that it sparked a lot of backlash across the Middle East, and some interpreted it as support for Israel amid, you know, ongoing military actions in Gaza. And a lot of MENA-based entrepreneurs and professionals criticized this visit, with some actually exploring alternatives to Stripe's payment platform. So not only are a lot of Middle Eastern entrepreneurs mad with Collison himself, but they're also boycotting the platform. Now, specifically influential figures in the MENA tech scene, including Jordanian entrepreneur Walid Daniel Dib and Endeavor Jordan board member Ziad Husban, publicly questioned Stripe's position and called for regional alternatives. Even Dubai-based fintech platforms like Zina and Mamo are being evaluated as potential replacements. Yeah. And I specifically find that point really interesting because of the fact that, you know, this specific platform went down, and the first one people are looking at for replacements, the first ones actually are in Dubai.
Yeah.
That is so interesting to me.
Yeah, even in the comments on X, on his post, people were like, oh, use this, use that. There's like a whole list now. I try to let's get that list from people's comments. But there's a lot of fintech solutions, like payment solutions, for founders, the Arab founders especially, who found this post quite in bad taste.
And rightfully so.
Yeah, and even there's a picture of him like nearly 10 years ago where he is in Palestine. So he has visited the land. He's seen everything firsthand. He also supported one of the Palestinian startups. So he's been there.
Yeah.
It's not like me. I've never been there. So I only see pictures and videos. I've never seen it live.
No, but
he's been there.
I think when you take a look at this entire post, I think what's more offensive than the fact in itself that he visited Tel Aviv, I think it's the fact that he's showing that he's enjoying it too.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? Because a lot of countries, a lot of businesses, they do maintain very diplomatic relationships with Israel. But this one, it's not just a diplomatic relationship. This is an enjoyable one.
Yeah.
You know, he's enjoying his run. And so I understand why people would find that very techie. Why they wouldn't like it.
The important thing is that some of the payment platforms, they actually, from their account, came and were like, okay, we're here. So Mamo is a startup, the way we startup. They came, they started posting on all the posts that were there on LinkedIn, X, everywhere. So it was a good opportunity for them to
capitalize on it.
Yeah, even on our Instagram post, a lot of founders from those, they came and they were like, yeah, you can use our services. Some of the names we would love to take, obviously, we would try to promote them. Zina, they recently got a $22 million funding. We did a story on them. It really did good. Everyone loved the story coming out of Dubai, UAE. There's Tap Payments, there's MoneyHash from comments. All these are suggested by people who are using them. So there's Hyperpay, there's Tap Payments, there's Teller also. We did a Dreamers episode on the founder of Teller recently. Last Monday. So yeah, you can go find out.
But you know, imagine
about that
when I take a look at this entire story, I really do think he needs better PR.
Yeah.
I think he needs better PR. He should not just be posting anything.
Yeah.
Especially at the time and age that we live in. I mean, this in itself, this entire post, this is like breeding ground. This is breeding ground for competition. It's breeding ground for just people taking down your business entirely.
Yeah. But it's been added, Stripe has been added to the boycott list. There's an app which was tagged by one of the people who commented on it, Boycat app. It lets you scan the barcodes of the products that you're using to tell you the origin, where they're coming from, or if they have any affiliations with the people who are recently doing atrocities across the world, not only Israel. So they said, okay, bye-bye. I downloaded the app, actually. I went on the list. They have categories. So if someone is a direct Israeli-founded company, they have it on category one. If someone has weak association, if someone has a distant association. Yeah, so this app, I went, and they didn't have Stripe yesterday, but today in the morning I checked and they have Stripe now in the second category.
Do you think every kind of association makes a difference?
Yeah, as a brand, see, everyone now with the consumer that we have right now, he's very educated, not in the sense of knowledge and wisdom, I won't say that, but he's very educated in what is happening. So if they know that this brand represents this idea, and if they're against that idea, they will stop using the brand. So it's a good movement. It's a big movement that
it
is happening.
It is. Yeah. And we're seeing now more than ever that business owners, they need to be so aware of who their consumers are and what they stand for. And a really good example of this is Majid Al Futtaim. Just recently, we saw that in Jordan, you know, amid the boycotts against Carrefour, what happened is that they replaced it with an entirely new supermarket.
And they made it local. So now Jordan Carrefour is turned into a local store, which will have local products from Jordan. So it's good for the Jordan economy and Jordanian products.
Exactly.
And they understood the environment, the business environment, which is very difficult.
And the cultural environment.
Yeah. And they changed it. So it's a very nice move coming from, again, a very Emirati product, Majid Al Futtaim. They own the franchises across the Middle East. In Jordan, everyone was boycotting Carrefour because Carrefour is basically French. That's a French company. But they're franchising there.
You know, Majid, it's really interesting that you brought up how Majid Al Futtaim owns a lot of enterprises across the Middle East. You know, is it perhaps that, you know, this happened with Stripe because of the fact that it's not so big? Because now what I'm seeing this trend of that the bigger that companies are, the more that they know the stakes are high, and the more that they need to be more careful in every single step that they take.
Actually, to be honest, Stripe is big, but it's big in the sense that it's a private startup. It hasn't gone public. Yeah. It hasn't taken a lot of investment right now. It has actually, but not that big. But in the private circles, it's a big useful thing that everyone used. That is why the backlash is so big, because everyone was using them for the comfort that it gave you and the ease of use, basically. So now we have other startups, so let's see what happens.
Yeah, and finally, for our last topic today, founded in 1948, Puma is one of the third largest sportswear brands in the world, and their story for today is that they have finally ended Israel's Football Association sponsorship after boycott campaigns. Yeah. Again, we are seeing the power of boycotts now more than ever. Yeah. Now, especially in this political climate. Previously, what I've seen is they have not worked that much. Yeah. But now we're seeing this. We're seeing this with the backlash that the CEO of Stripe has received. We're seeing this with how just recently McDonald's reported a 1% decline in revenue. And now we're seeing that Puma itself, like, you know, it's the third largest athletic wear manufacturer. Yeah. They've just ended a sponsorship completely. So what basically happened is that they announced on December 31st, on 2024, that following this very sustained five-year global boycott campaign, that it will end this sponsorship. Now, this boycott was driven by 215 Palestinian sports teams and global activists, which protested Puma's association with the IFA, and which includes like teams in illegal Israeli settlements. Now, the actions against Puma included protests, office occupations, phone and online disruptions, and public appeals to artists and sportswear teams to sever ties with the brand. This is absolutely insane. People really came together here in every single way that mattered to end this sponsorship, and we can see that it worked.
Yeah, it started in 2018, so 4 years nearly of doing all the boycott divestment, and finally it's been done. One of the big brands doing it is like a sign that it's happening. Yeah. It's happening, actually.
It's
people
happening.
Are actually looking at brands and then finding out which brand supports which. There's a whole list by BDS movement itself. They update it, they keep it updated, the website is there, the socials are there. So let's see which big brand next comes and says, okay, thank you very much, not associating with
you. And you know,
Majid,
I'm so baffled by this entirely, because if you remember, I made the argument that boycotts don't work. But now I'm being proved wrong in every single way.
Yeah.
They do work. However, but interestingly, you know, just recently we saw that Puma's ex-brother, Adidas, just recently they took Bella Hadid completely off of a campaign simply because it had ties with Israel. And Israel didn't like the fact that a Palestinian model was representing the campaign entirely. So basically what the campaign was, it was for these shoes from the Munich Olympics. And during the Munich Olympics, there was a bunch of Israeli athletes that were killed. And basically what it was is that Israel found it very offensive that Bella Hadid was specifically representing the campaign. However, in this case, we saw how Adidas was not in support of Bella Hadid. They were in support of Israel. But it's interesting how their ex-brother, Puma, they're completely in support of Palestine.
No, it's good. I would just say boycotts work. I don't mind boycotts. The only thing is that...
Do you boycott?
Yeah, sometimes. Depends. But I would just say boycotts do work, but you need cohesion in a boycott movement. This time, the good thing, it's not a good thing in the perspective of Palestinians, but it's a good thing that the world has seen a lot of what is happening. It's been aired, it's been shared on social media. There's people from inside Palestine and Gaza who've documented the whole genocide. The photographer, it just jumped out of my head, his name. But he, all the reporters there, they've documented it from the ground. So now even people who denied that, oh, nothing is happening and all that, they have seen the first-hand account. So that is why you see a cohesion, a coming together of a whole Muslim or Islamic or Middle Eastern community.
Yeah.
So as a community, when you put pressure together without like some people saying, no, then it makes a difference.
Yeah,
so boycotts need a lot of cohesion and a lot of coming together.
That
is why it's working.
What Majid here is saying, it's very interesting. So if you're trying to boycott a brand and you actually want it to work, a cohesive approach with a lot of people, with a lot of tactics, it could actually work out for you. Yeah. And with that being said, do tune with us in a while. We have the co-founders of Argo Anchor Shipping coming up now.
So we're going on a break and we'll come back in 30 seconds, 1 minute maximum.
Yeah. Led by CEO Anirudh Mohan and co-founder Fazan Chataiwala, Argo Anchor Shipping is redefining global logistics with reliable, sustainable solutions. Specializing in transportation, supply chain management, and storage, this rising company is a trusted partner for eco-friendly and efficient logistics worldwide. Thank you so much for making it today. Just to start off, could you start by telling us about your roles at Argo Anchor Shipping and how you became involved with the company in general?
So I think we've both known each other for about 8 years now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Back from Mumbai in India. And in the same industry, right? We've been in shipping for about 10, 12 years now. He's been in shipping since about 2016 now.
Yeah. So it's 8 years.
And we worked as customers, we worked as partners, we worked as vendors, and now we're working together with Argo. So that's how the entire idea came up, because like-minded people, right? We know the industry.
Yeah.
We know how each other of us, you know, operate. And that's how this entire idea came up.
Oh, okay. I see. And, you know, I know that you guys are really, with all the experience that you have, that you just told me about, you're really trying to revolutionize the logistics industry. Could you, like, elaborate more on how your company is going to achieve this through innovation and technology?
I mean, revolutionize is a pretty strong word. I just think that, so shipping industry has always been family-led. It has been a very close-knit industry wherein, you know, generations, they're just in this business for like 2 decades, 3 decades, yeah. 5 decades. Where we come is, I think we bring fresher ideas, younger people into the table to work with us. And there's a shift that is happening right now in this industry wherein it is moving from family-led businesses to, you know, multinational companies having yeah. mergers and acquisitions wherein DP Worlds, Abu Dhabi Ports, they're all coming into the picture. So you cannot really work the way you used to work before. And we understand and yes. we adapt to this new thinking. And we centralize our thinking according to this need of the hour, which is there right now.
And I think the approach that we have is that we believe a lot of times the shipping industry, compared to other industries, is 30 years behind. So in terms of technology, in terms of training, and I think our emphasis is majorly on that. Also, you know, we want to make shipping exciting for people. A lot of times people don't think about shipping. And COVID was one time that people all of a sudden realized how important shipping was. And
keeping it the industry. It came at a cost, but yeah.
Came at a cost, but we want to keep the industry yeah. interesting for newer generations, have new ideas come in, have newer talent come in, and yeah, make the world a better place.
Yeah. You know, just for the next point, now, you guys provide a wide range of logistics services from ocean freight to custom clearance. Which service segment is the most in demand and what differentiates it specifically in the market?
So I think ocean freight is what we sell the most, right? Yeah. Basically, we are a box operator, we are a container operator. We provide containers on lease or on rent, if I can say it in that way. From point A to point B, this is our most sought after product. And this is what we focus on. We call ourselves an NVOCC, which means a non-vessel operating container carrier. So we don't own ships, but we own containers, right? This is what we do. I mean, it's too technical, but this is what we do. When I say what makes us different, I think there are, when we checked, there are about 1,800 people in Dubai who do the same thing that we do.
Exactly the same thing
that
we do. Wow. Right.
And competition is insane.
Yes.
We don't call it competition. That is what makes us different. So we believe in collaborating. We don't have competitors. I think the major players over here today in Dubai, they know us very well. We try to collaborate with them as much as possible, which in turn helps their business, our business, and the industry as a whole. So the moment we try to run this rat race and, you know, try to step over someone, we are just on the losing side.
Wow. So. You know, I don't think I've ever heard somebody say before that they don't have competitors. That's so interesting. Now, I can see here that, you know, collaboration, flexibility and reliability, they're your key values. But how do you ensure that these values that you guys just told me about, that they're consistently delivered to clients globally?
So as I said, we put a lot of emphasis on getting technology in place, and a lot of times technology has helped us in certain ways to eliminate a lot of manual intervention from possibly a human error or something, that how we can improve our systems. I think after getting invested a lot into technology, we've improved our efficiency levels by 40%, and I think that's the way we go. With AI and machine learning coming in place, I think there's a lot of changes that will happen drastically and in a very short future. So I think this is I wouldn't say a decade, but I'd say a couple of years, there'll be a complete transformation in the whole industry.
You know, it's so insane that you say that you guys improved everything by 40%, considering the fact you just started 2 years ago, right?
Yes, we started a year and a half, 2 years, second year going
on. Wow, imagine that. They started that long ago and they're already improving things by 40%. I find that insane. Now, with an active presence in the Gulf, the Far East and South Asia, how does Argo Anchor, you know, adapt its operations to different regions?
So, firstly, I think Southeast Asia and the Middle East is just one of a few sectors. We're actually working with Europe, the US, and, you know, multiple time zones right now. I think key is hiring like-minded people as well. We focus a lot on our recruitment, our hiring, and adaptability, and people would want to work because it's a 7-day job, right? I mean, tomorrow we have a holiday for the next 4 days, right? I mean, shipping doesn't have a holiday. So we're working 365 days. The ports are working 365 days. So I think adaptability and hiring like-minded people is a major
Yeah.
Amazing.
And we also believe that hiring the right kind of talent is important, but also letting them work and letting them do what they are best at, rather than, you know, intervening and telling them what has to be done, is something that what usually limits a lot of talent. So I think letting them what they want to do and trusting them, giving them enough responsibility.
I think empowerment and delegation.
Absolutely.
We believe a lot in empowerment and delegation of the work. Mistakes are bound to happen. We make mistakes.
He makes mistakes.
So that's fine. I think opportunity is what we want to give people so that they feel that they are responsible for something, and in turn we get accountability as well.
You know, it's really interesting that you mentioned that trust factor, because like I remember in my previous job, I worked under two managers. First one didn't trust me. Second one did. Yeah. I performed better under the second one just because they trusted me, and that trust, it like gave me more confidence. But like, I'm so like curious, like what are the traits that you guys specifically look for in people when you hire them?
I think first and foremost is commitment to work. If at all, I mean, it doesn't really matter whether they know the job or they do not know the job, because training is relatively easy. We can always train someone to, you know, work for us or work for the company's goal. But getting the right kind of talent who has the right mindset, I would say, is the key that we look at over here.
I think also in terms of letting them, training them is something which is very important that we look into, but also allowing them, it is not necessary whether they come from a specific, they've done a specific course or not. I think the energy that they carry and the mentality of, you know, we can get it done, or there has to be another solution or finding a way out, I think that is what usually, this is one quality that you usually specifically look for.
Okay, so it's that energy. And just speaking of industries in general, how significant is the maritime industry to the UAE's economy?
So I think back in 2021, the UAE, the shipping and maritime industry contributed about 135 billion
dirhams
towards the GDP in 2021. And there has been a significant increase of about 25%.
25% plus, I think you've got close to 150,000 people being employed
within
directly
the shipping,
by the shipping industry in Dubai. And Dubai has always played a very pivotal role geographically and even in history because of trade. And I think how shipping is advancing, you have a lot of work that the countries are doing to improve and make it easier for a lot of shipping companies to establish base out here.
Dubai is also a transshipment hub, right? Connecting the east to the west, as you rightly said right now, provides a, it's a very pivotal hub for transshipment of cargo as well. So not necessarily that this cargo is meant for the UAE or something, but it is connected via Dubai. So geographically, I think Dubai over the last 20, 25 years has reinforced its name over here. And I think it's here to stay. I mean, GCC as such is coming up right now. Dubai is not the only port. There are multiple other ports within the UAE and GCC which is coming up right now, which is going to be equally important in the next few years.
And you know, what is the current market size of the UAE's freight and logistics sector, and what is its growth potential? Do you guys see the growth potential in this, and how?
I think yes, potential is always there. And especially with the mindset the leadership has out here, they want to boost it. With the DP World in place, with the
Khalifa Port
in place, there's a lot that these guys are doing, not only in terms directly with Dubai, but they're creating a proper ecosystem for the whole supply chain. They want to make it easier for your customers to get their package, be it your Amazon packages or be it your car, be it anything. At one point, it has been on a shipping container.
Always.
Okay.
So whatever comes in from China, whatever it is, it's always been in a shipping container, right? And they're always trying to enhance the productivity of the delivery to the end customer. Quick commerce was never a thing some time back. Today's date, you order something, it's there in 2 hours or what, 3 hours, 1 hour, 20 minutes and all of that. So, and as we spoke before, from a family-led business, shipping is now moving towards
an investor-run,
or I would say multinational-backed businesses, right? Wherein governments are now investing in shipping companies. ports, DP World, Khalifa Port, they're all owned by the government. I mean, over here, there.
Yeah.
So when that kind of money inflows, obviously they see a potential for growth over there.
Okay, and what role does the maritime sector play in employment within the UAE?
So I would firstly say within the GCC, 50% of the crude oil exports are happening from the GCC. And because of which, there's a framework that has been created. So if you have exports, if you have this large number of exports, you obviously need imports. You need to take care of livelihood of so many number of people within these ports or working for these exports, right? And I think that's how an ecosystem is built, wherein the crude is just the beginning of the product, right?
Yes.
Today's date, I think UAE as such, we have multiple other products that are being exported from here. And more than that, it's a very big importers market as well. India plays a big role for the UAE over here. And all the three ports, all the four major ports in the UAE are thriving because of this business right now.
Yeah. And just for the last question, you know, how significant is, you know, the entire industry, not just to the UAE, but to the Gulf region's economy?
I think, as Anirudh mentioned, crude oil is something that's very important. But apart from crude, there are a lot of things that as in anything you touch, anything you feel, anything you can think of has something to do with shipping. And the importance in the whole region, as I say, with the kind of projects that are being announced, the kind of development that is planned for the next, you've got the 2030 vision, you've got Saudi making big development announcements.
Yeah,
I think the kind of potential that lies for the maritime industry and as well as for all the countries in this area, I think it's huge.
Yeah, it definitely is really huge. And thank you so much for coming today, really. Yeah. I really enjoyed talking with you guys. You know, we can see that they have already improved their efficiency by 40% through technology, and they've only just started in less than 2 years. I'm really excited to see what more you guys are going to do. Thank you so much. This is Smashy Business. Smashy Business production, a part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. Make sure to tune in with us on Instagram, Beehive for our newsletter, and X and LinkedIn. And have a lovely, lovely weekend and a lovely National Day holiday. Thank you.